right, Gary. Thank you. Thank you very much.
They did little things, haven't they?
It's what you need. Yeah. Let me borrow every now and again. Right. So, could you firstly tell me a little bit about growing up in Hunslet and how you got into rugby league?
Oh yeah, well, I grew up in Hunslet from a point of view. I'm a Balaar lad, so there's three different parts. There's Balaar, Middleton, and Hunslet. And I can reassure you, the rivalry between the three, because we all came from different schools and different areas of there. So there's a bit of rivalry there. So really, I'm a Balaar boy. That's what I'll admit to, rather than a Hunslet lad, to be honest with you. And yeah, it all started at Clapgate School. First went there at 5 years of age, and it was quite simple. We had a headmaster called Mr. Harry Jepson, everybody knows Mr. Harry Jepson. Throughout rugby league, he was always the headmaster, and it was simple. It was rugby league for the boys and netball for the girls, so there was no other sport to play. And first started playing at 8 years of age, and that's where it all started from. So in the end, so from a point of view of playing a sport, there was no option. You either played rugby league or you did nothing. Simple as that at school.
So you never played football, anything else?
He was very, very interested at Clapgate, because a round ball wasn't allowed. Even at playtime, you was not allowed to bring a round ball in, because Mr. Jepson was very much a stickler. He was very much a stickler. It's rugby league at this school for the boys, and it's netball. Well, the girls can play anything they want. They can play around us, can do what they want. But as far as with the lads went, with the boys, they went, and they say it was only the oval-shaped ball, and it was rugby league.
So did you have any sort of, like, did your dad, uncle, brothers, grandparents?
My father, was a footballer, and he played football his life. He played representative football at district level and county level, and so, but he had no obligations whatsoever about me just playing rugby league, or saying, no, well, I'm going to take you to a football school, or I want you to play football. No, he was a footballer, and very much my inspiration, and my best mate from that, to be honest with you.
So did you first start playing at school and then move into like a junior club, or was it a club then school?
We started at Clapgate as under nines. We had a great rugby teacher, Roy Dougal, and my teammate as well at the time was David Creaser. As we all know, Dave Creaser went on to play for Leeds International career, had a very successful rugby league career himself. So Dave Creaser, he started at the fullback, I started at the standoff. I was a greedy so-and-so. The first two years I scored 65 tries. The second season I scored 53 tries. It was interesting for my dad as well, because I think I skipped my dad in the first 2 years, because he said to me, he's 15, in them days it was quite a bit of money, it was 15p for a try and 10p for a goal. So after two years it stopped, because 65 and 53. So I took a bit of pocket money off him anyway. So but after 2 years, Mr. Dougal, he moved Dave Creese at standoff, I moved to centre, with a combination from there. So and at Clapgate under Mr. Dougal, the side, what we had, we had a great side. We all played together at Clapgate, we all played together for Hunter Schoolboys. Yeah. And at Clapgate, believe it or not, we went four years unbeaten, and we only had one try scored against us. One try in 4 years.
4 years.
And when we got that scored against us, it was against Royal Park. We beat Royal Park at the old Archie Archie Gordon ground at Kirksville there, which is no longer there. We beat them 48-3, but you would felt that we had got beaten, because we had that try concede. I think it was around about the third game of the last game we were ever going to play together at Clapgate.
Right.
So we were absolutely distraught that it happened. But yeah, we won every trophy going, and we all went on to play for Hunter Schoolboys at under 13 level, and that's where it started, at Clapgate.
Did you grow up a Leeds supporter then, being from Leeds?
Yeah, I was a Leeds man. And the first time I got my hands on the Challenge Cup was when Mr. Jepson brought it to the school when Leeds won it in 77 and 78. And the first time, I met John Holmes and Kevin Dick and John Atkinson and Alan Smith and David Ward. So it was great.
Yeah,
it was brilliant. And my ambition was, as a 9-year-old, to be a professional rugby league player. And Leeds was my club, and I wanted to sign for Leeds when if I was going to be good enough, and when the time came along.
Yeah. So did you have, like, in terms of sporting role models? And like rugby league role models, were they all Leeds players, or were they Aussies, Kiwis, anything like that?
To be honest with you, I didn't have any role models. No, I didn't. And the only game, I was asked this question the other day, my mate Colin Maskell asked me, how many rugby league games did I go to when I was growing up? Well, I went to one. was right. When I went, because my dad knew Sid Hines and he knew Kenny Eyre at school, the old run school he went to. And so he took me to one game at Headley. It was a Saturday afternoon. They beat Widnes 33-3, and that's the only game I really went to, because I played Saturdays and Sundays when it's for school. And then from school we went to Hunslick Parkside from there. That's when it all started. From a point of view where scouts started watching you at Hunslick Parkside, when we went there as 12-year-olds. But as far as boyhood heroes, I didn't have any. But obviously I know the players, the class of players, yeah, of the likes of your John Holmes and your David Toplesses and the likes of then Sid Hines. I thought Sid Hines was sensational at Leeds, but as far as copying anybody, no, I didn't really have the hero, to be honest with you.
No. So what are your experiences progressing from likes of schoolboy rugby at Parkside up into the professional game through like say getting scouted and things like that?
Well, the great thing about it is when you're at school, it's all about Hunslet schoolboys, Yorkshire schoolboys. Then when you get to 16, England schoolboys. But it's quite interesting at Yorkshire schoolboys under 13s. I never played fullback in my life, and if I'm honest with you, even in my professional career, you know, I wasn't a very good tackler. And for the second game, I got picked as fullback, and I said to my dad, "I said, Dad, they picked me at fullback. What do I do at fullback?" He just said, "Well, if anybody breaks through, you just tackle them," and that's all I did. And from that day, my dad said, "Well, you just proved here. You just proved." Lancashire beat us, because Lancashire had a great side. They had Sean Wainey, because in them days, Wainey were the best player in the country. There's no doubt about that. Sean Wainey up to under 13s, up to under 16 level, whether it's playing for to his school. I think he went to St John Fisher and Wigan St Pat's, where he played, and up to schoolboy level. Sean was the best player, easy at the schoolboy level in our era. And it was the coming of age for myself has been learning on you, knowing that if I could tackle, then that day for Yorkshire at fullback said to me that if I wanted to, I could get stuck in a little bit.
So how did your move come about to go to Hull?
Well, how it came, we started going to Hunslet Parkside. Again, we all moved from Clapgate. We went to Parkside High School. We had a great coach there as well in John Ball. And we had two great sides, because with that many lads who wanted to play, we had an A team and a B team.
Right.
And the thing about it was the A team and the B team at Parkside always played in every final, because we were that good. We had so much quality at schoolboy level. It was great to see. And so we all went to Hunslet Parkside. And we started off with a great coach in Ron Tinker. We all moved there together, and then from Hunslet Parkside we all stayed together. We won everything, from whether it was the local competition, the Yorkshire competition, the national competition. We went on to win the National Cup under 18 level. We hammered Kells, things around about 33 points to 6 or something like that at Blackpool. Dave Creaser was outstanding, a couple of tries, kicked about 8 goals and what have you. So, and that's when the scouts started watching you. The scouts started watching me at around about 15 years of age. Leeds, the big scout in them days, what Eric Hawley. Leeds were chasing me at 15. But there was a Barla tour coming up at under 18 level in 1983. So my ambition was to go on that tour. My ambition was to be captain of that tour. And so as far as anybody could assign me, then it was a waste of time, because I wasn't bothered about signing professional until I'd made that tour, been on that tour. And that's when that's when I signed for Hull. But that was a very, very successful tour as well, the Barla 83 tour. I think it's the best tour that's left these shores. We went there certainly as underdogs. France had beaten us at Barlaymore before we set off. And we went there as massive underdogs. We weren't even given a cat and else chance, not to draw the test series, but we were supposed to, because the New Zealand schoolboys in them days were the Aussies, you know, they were just as good as what they were.
Yeah.
So we were supposed to not win a game, never mind come back winning 7 out of 8, so that was a quality side as well. So it all started with the scouts. When you start playing, when you was in the amateur days, when you start getting picked for Barla and England schoolboys up to 16 years of age, that's when the scouts start coming, knocking on your door and showing interest to you to be signing for them as a professional.
So as well as did you have any other looking?
Oh yeah, plenty. To be honest with you, there were plenty. Leeds were obviously from 15, and there's obviously Hunslet there, and Wigan was in. There were plenty, but Hull, to be honest with you, they'd never seen me play. They wanted to sign me in the recommendation of Gary Devorty, because they were chasing Gary Devorty from the Barla side, and I'm led to believe Robbie Devorty and Gary said, "Listen, you know, you go watch Ishan Schofield because he's a quality player. He's going to be our captain. He's the centre, so go watch him. So, but they never even see me play. They came to watch me play at Dewsbury 18, but it was called off. Anyway, so they never saw me play. They asked me to go over training. I went over training. Fellas, I was part of that club. Fellas, I've been part of that team for 2 years. There's only been one training session, and that was straight with the first team. And so it convinced me then that with a recommendation that Dave Topler said to Arthur Bunting, that, hey, listen, this young kid's ready for first team football now. So what a mark of respect that was from the great man himself, when he's saying to Arthur Bunting, an 18-year-old is ready to go straight into that whole first team.
Yeah.
When you look at all the internationals in that back line,
yeah,
it was a tremendous honour, not just signing for Hull, but giving the opportunity by Arthur Bunting.
So, like I said, you didn't really watch or go to many rugby games. So, because obviously Hull's a massive club, did Hull being such a big club and such a historic club play a part in that, or was it just you being welcomed so well as you went there?
Oh yeah, just being welcomed so well, but also too, my philosophy was, it came from my dad, quite simple, as an 8-year-old, you know, he just said to me, hey, listen son, don't you worry about any opposition, let them worry about you.
Yeah.
So it wasn't anything big-headed or overconfident, it was just something that my dad said to me, you know, because what I had as a kid, I had plenty of pace.
Yeah.
I had pace, and When I talk about the coaches, Roy Dougal were brilliant as a schoolboy coach, so was John Ball, so was Ron Tinker, but they never took anything away from all the players who played in that area. So they never took anything away from me, and Arthur Bunting were exactly the same. You know, when you've got quality players around you, and when I was 18 years of age, all I did when I went to the training sessions before I signed, I watched what the players did, and I knew Steve Norton wanted to pass the ball.
Yeah.
So did Lee Crook, so did Mick Crane, so did David Topless.
Yeah.
And you know, so it was quite simple for me. When they were making the breaks, I was going to be making sure I was supporting them on the left and right side, and that's how it worked out. And Arthur Bunting were brilliant for me by giving me an opportunity.
So, how different was it? Because obviously you moved to Leeds after that. How different was it moving to Leeds as moving to Hull? Was it as sort of a welcoming environment as you experienced that?
Oh yeah, yeah, of course it was. You know, as I say, I had 4 great years at Hull. My first season as a pro, you know, topped the try scoring charts, 38 tries, the English player to do that as an 18-year-old, got selected for the Great Britain Tour. So if it wasn't for Arthur Bunting and Hull FC and all them great players, I wouldn't have been anywhere near the rugby league player I was. Nowhere made, you know, being the most capped Great Britain player with Mick Sullivan, and gone on to do what I did. So Hull FC put me on the not just on the rugby league map, but they put me on the international map. You know, getting picked for my first tour. In 18 years of age, the youngest ever tourist to Australia, you know. So it was Hull FC who put me on the rugby league map, international map, and say playing with all the great players, it was quite easy really, because they did all the hard work. All I did was just back up and score the tries. But moving to Leeds, no, it wasn't an issue whatsoever. Everybody knew the situation at Hull. They were skint. They had to sell the two assets with myself and Lee Crooks. So coming home was a great move. World record, $378,000. I didn't feel the pressure. I never put the transfer value on my head, and it was great to be coming home.
Yeah, going back to being 18 and being picked for the tour, was it fully, obviously you scored a fair few tries for Hull, was it fully expected to go on that tour for yourself? Like, did you expect the phone call?
No, if I'm honest with you, because I made my test debut in January and had an absolute stinker, an absolute nightmare. We played France at Headingley, the most boring game I've ever played in. It was 10-0, David Hobkin, 5 penalty goals, most boring game I've been with. I had an absolute stinker myself. But fair credit to Frank Myler, the coach, who was going to be the Great Britain coach to take the tour away. He just said to me, hey, listen, Scoy, he says, forget about that. Anybody can have a stinker, which I did. But he was open and honest. He said, hey, listen, keep going how you're going, and you never know what's going to happen at the end of the season.
Yeah.
You know? So, but I felt as though the opportunity had gone, that my international career maybe there were 2 or 3 years down the line. But hey, listen, finished the top try score and managed to get picked for that 84 tour, which again, very, very grateful to Frank Myler and his coaching staff.
Great Britain's a massive achievement. Was it something in particular that you always wanted to do as a player, like represent Great Britain?
Everybody wants to represent the country, and if it only happens once, then you've achieved your dream, you've achieved your ambition. But if anybody just said to me, you know, I'd have done it 46 times, the same as a legendary player himself, Mick Sullivan, being on 4 Great Britain tours, captain Great Britain 13 times, scored 31 tries for Great Britain, kicked 7 drop goals, then I would have said, well, you're bonkers.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely, you know.
Yeah.
To do it once is the achievement. To do it, say, like I did then, it's a dream come true.
So, all rugby players going about how they love going on tour, yeah. How great on tour. What are your sort of memories as going on tour on the 84?
Well, being on tour, it's obviously it's a challenge because you're not just playing the test football, you're going into a country where it's a totally different environment.
Yeah.
This word nowadays is the word culture. And you're going into places like Wagga Wagga, you're going to places like Tamworth, you're going to places like Rockhampton, which is absolute rugby barmy.
Yeah.
You're playing against people who hate you, you know, because you're an Englishman, you're a sportsman against them. I'm not saying they hurt you as people.
Yeah.
After the game, no, we all were friends and we all had beers together and what have you.
Yeah.
But yeah, going into a totally different environment, it's not just an experience but an eye-opener, the rivalry between the English and the Australians, and rightly so. It's been there for how many years now? I don't know, 100 years or something, you know, since I've been playing, whether it's rugby league, rugby union, cricket or what have you. So that rivalry is great from there. In 84, a real eye-opener, and if I'm honest with you, I felt as though, was I part of it? Well, I was just like a lost sheep, if I'm honest, because I had loads of experience. But all I did in 84, it was a very successful tour for me, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, I scored the best, scored my test debut against Australia, scored on the first game. The second test in Brisbane, scored the best try I've ever scored in my career.
Yeah.
Went down as a try of the decade in the 80s. So I just felt as though, well, I'm the youngest. Realistically, I've got to sit down, watch, listen, and what goes on, and that's exactly what I did. You know, I took notice of all the senior pros, the little things what they did, the mishaps what they did, the great things what they did, and it was a great learning curve for me in 84.
That put you in good stead going into the 88?
Well, 88, you know, I was still a young lad, I guess. What was I, 20? Yeah, 23 on my second tour from there, and just building my reputation realistically as a settled Great Britain player, you know.
Yeah.
Literally, if you looked at that side, you would say, yes, Ellery was part of the furniture, Andy Gregg were part of the furniture, Lee Crooks were part of the furniture, I guess myself, you know, from there. But you still had to prove yourself a little bit, because we changed as coaches then in Mal, really. So Mal wasn't a stickler for reputations, you know, so you had to make sure you were performing. Else you wouldn't be selected. So yeah, I got selected for my second tour in 88, and still, I was still, I would say, not one of the most seniors of players in there, in the pros. You know, I was still only 23 years of age. So, but I felt comfortable that I was a test player now when I went on the 88 tour.
Yeah. So obviously you made a couple of moves out to Australia as well to play for like Balmain. Do you think that sort of put you at an advantage? Like you played in them sort of environments and you've been there?
Not really. No, because, as I say, I went to Balmain 85 after my 84 tour, but great for Frank Stanton to say to me as a 19-year-old, hey, listen, this is what coach is all about for me, and my management is, you know, you've got a free role here, you know, you're here to score us tries, and I did exactly that under Frank. I finished at the top try scorer for Balmain the 2 years. I'm the only Englishman at the top of the try scoring charts in Australia in 1986. So, great learning curve again, a coach who saw something in me, gave me the respect, and just let me play.
Yeah.
How he knew he would get the best out of me. But for your international point of view, you're still going to be performing, whether you're performing in Australia or in England.
Yeah.
You've still got to be playing to your ability, if not, because in them days we had some quality centres about, you know. There were Carl Gibson, there were Paul Loughran, there were Dave Stevenson, there was myself, there was Grant Anderson, there was Sean Irwin, there was Darryl Powell, there was John Joyner still. So you had to play to the best of your ability to be selected for the national side, because if you didn't, then you weren't going to get selected. We changed this coach from Maurice Bamford to Mal, really. And we'll be for sure, Mal didn't pick people on reputations.
No.
If you were playing, you got picked. If you won, then you were waiting to be selected again if you got your form back.
Did you feel, so obviously, going back to the 88, there was a number of Leeds players, obviously, including yourself, that got selected. Did you feel like you was representing Leeds as well as Great Britain whilst you were on tour?
It's only Great Britain. You're not there as a club. No, you're there as a Great Britain player. Yeah, I won't deny the facts that these clicks when you go on tour. You're trying to avoid that, but these clicks, and that happens.
Yeah.
Well, the only tour where I went on in 1999, there were no clicks in there because it was a young side, and we were led brilliantly by Mike Gregory. But they are clicks there, and most of the time, I would say 80-85% of the time, that's unavoidable.
You think that'll always be the case?
Yeah, it will. Yeah, it will, because, you know, when you're playing against each other week in and week out, you're trying to bash each other, you're trying to knock each other's heads off and all this sort of thing. So, yeah, there'll always be clicks.
Right.
Always be clicks.
What were your experiences of the first game in Papua New Guinea? Was that your first time?
I didn't go in 84 because I came home in 84 early as well with shin splints. So I didn't go to New Guinea in 84. Papa, yeah, it's the heat what does you. It's the heat what.
I thought it was around 38 degrees.
Yeah, it's the heat what does you. But as far as the people welcoming you, there's no better place.
Right.
It's absolutely sensational. They just love the rugby league. As we all know, it's their national game from there. And as far as a welcoming and as far as the respect what you show you, there's no better place. I'll tell you, there's no better place than the Papua New Guineans giving you the respect what you deserve. And when you look at the support, you know, there's people who walk for 2 and 3 days from different parts of the country to try and get to the ground and just to see not just a Great Britain side, but to see their heroes as well who are playing for their national side.
There's obviously a massive culture and tradition in the likes of Papua New Guinea, Samoa, New Zealand. Do you think the sort of history of rugby league and their like things like the haka, like preserving that history, do you think that benefits there going into the game?
Of course it does. But you've got to respect that as well, because when they do all these like the haka or the other countries, as I say, like the Tongans and the Samoans and the Fijians, you know, they it's their sort of tribal dance, and you've got to respect that because it's a challenge. It's a challenge what they're setting you.
Yeah.
So you've got to take that challenge on, and if. I'd be telling lies if I said it's not intimidating.
Yeah.
It is very, very intimidating there, but as I say, it's a challenge. The challenge what you've got to accept, and then you've got 80 minutes to sort it out. Simple as that.
Do you think we have, and obviously it's England and Scotland and everyone else now, do you think back then there was the same sort of history and heritage in wearing the Great Britain jersey?
Oh, back then, yeah, of course. Nothing better.
Do you think we'd benefit from bringing it back?
Oh, yeah, we need to bring Great Britain back. It was ridiculous in the first place why it got disbanded. And I say Richard Lewis did it, and we all know why, for financial reasons, which is absolutely pathetic.
Yeah.
Disrespectful to the Great Britain jersey, disrespectful to everybody who's put a Great Britain jersey on, disrespectful to the Great Britain Lions, and how he was allowed to get away with that, well, God only knows. But I'm delighted that Great Britain's going to be coming back, hopefully, in 2019, and they're going on the first tour since, 1996 or something like that, I'm led to believe. So, yeah.
So in regards to your walk games prior to the first test, there was a game labelled Black Sunday against the Northern Division where it was your 36-12 defeat, your first defeat on tour, and there was a famous 20-minute scolding from Mal really in the sheds afterwards. How did you start experiencing a loss in Australia?
When you're on tour, normally, and I say when we went, the first test match was about 7 or 8 games into the tour. So what you want to do, you want to go into that first test match unbeaten. Mal, and I say the way that Mal was, the competitor he was, everybody knows his reputation as a player, not just over here, but certainly in Australia. You know, Mal, if you ask any Australian, certainly from our day, who's the best player that's ever played in the NRL, then everybody will, you know, Mal really will win the vote, you know. So that's how much it meant to Mal, and rightly so.
Yeah.
It ripped into us. We'd set the goal of, quite simply, we'd make sure that we go and beat him before the first test. But unfortunately, it didn't work that way.
Yeah. Do you think the media sort of jumped on that and sort of wrote you off completely going into the first test?
Well, yeah, absolutely, of course, and rightly so. You know, Great Britain side should not be losing to a district side, should it, or a county side, whatever terminology they have it down there. You know, so yeah, it's simple. A Great Britain side, or any national side, whether it's a Great Britain side or it's a New Zealand side, and certainly when the Kangaroos come over here, you know, we know what they have done.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think they've lost to a club side now since 1982, have they? You know, so when they toured. So it should not happen, and I guess realistically, to be honest, it should be unacceptable that you get beat by a district side.
Yeah, you weren't playing, but you also got beat 30-0 by Manly as well. Did this affect the mood at all going into the first?
Was it disappointing, or it was hard to take? It was hard to take because the pressure was really on then.
Yeah.
The pressure was really on, not just from Mal and all the management, but from everybody, from the press, from the supporters, you know, the pressure was really on, and rightly so, because even a club side in Australia, we should not be losing the club side, because the Great Britain's best should be good enough to beat a club side in any Australian side.
Yeah. So the first test was the Century game, 100th game. Was there much sort of importance put on it being the 100th game, or was it just another game.
Yeah, just another test match. You know, another test match from there. But as I say, you know, they signed from, when we look at the, you know, 82 to 86, and still got, you know, the players in there, in Meninga's and Lewis's, yeah, and Sterling's, and, you know, and your Kenny's and Miles, and, you know, who would make, and Eric Gross, who would make the reputation from the 82 tour. So they was always going to be pretty hard to beat. But still, even though we'd had a bit of a rocky situation by losing a few games building up to the first test, we were always pretty confident that, yeah, that if we didn't win the test, then we'd certainly put up a good effort and certainly compete.
Yeah. So you obviously got injured 20 minutes in, and had to leave the field and then eventually go home. What were you, I mean, obviously you'd be good, but keep,
I played in that test match. I played in the full, it was the next game I got injured against Combined Queensland. I played in that test match. I didn't play that well, to be honest with you.
Right.
And if I'm honest, my form on that tour leading up to the first test in some of the games wasn't that impressive, if I'm honest with you, from there. But I played in the whole test, and then we played Combined Queensland the Tuesday after the test. And unfortunately, I went to tackle a second row around the legs, caught his knee, and depressed the cheekbone. So that was the end. That was the end of my tour in 88. Yeah, yeah.
Whilst you're on tour, did you read any of the media outlets or anything like that?
Of course you do.
Yeah.
Of course you do. Yeah. And any players, even to this day, if any players say they don't read newspapers,
yeah,
they don't read anything what people say about rugby league columns, like in our day, and we all know from today it's all social media. If anybody in any sport says they don't read what's said about them, they're telling lies.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course we did. Yeah. Of course we did.
Obviously in Australia, you'd lost a few games, you'd just been written off a little bit. How did the English media perceive it, or when you got home?
After the third test, didn't they? But getting home, you know, but at the end of the day, it's like, because I work in the media now, at the end of the day, the fellas don't make things up. They're only giving an opinion. They're only writing what they see.
Yeah.
And I know from a press point of view, if it's good, you'll tell them it's good. But if it's rubbish,
they'll tell it's rubbish.
Yeah. You know, so, again, you know, back in our days, I don't really think there were too many players who took the bat and ball on with the press to say that because we were playing rubbish, they were telling us that we were rubbish. Well, they're only commenting on what they're seeing, and rightly so.
Obviously, like I said, we won the third test, and it was obviously you beating an unbeaten Australia on their soil. Was there much sort of importance and much bigging it up back home from the media?
Well, I think it was the start of a massive. Corner that were about to be turned, because when you looked at the second test at Brisbane, we were absolutely awful.
Yeah.
The players themselves, to say Phil Ford, you know, all they wanted to do was just fight Australia, knock their heads off, you know, and it was an hopeless performance, you know. And Mal Reid asked a question, I don't know where that came from, because I didn't tell them to go out there and belt their heads off. Yeah, I wanted them to hurt Australia, but I wanted them to do it physically and I wanted to do it fair.
Yeah.
So the second test performance was pathetic, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But the third test, well, all the talking point from the third test is, and the great thing from Mal's point of view, he was listening to what the Australian media were saying about us, you know. Why the hell they're turning up? Nine players have gone home. Why the hell they're turning up? Yeah. They're struggling to make a 15.
Yeah.
Look at these sort of players, they're not even good enough, you'd say. I think they were saying some of us, or some of them lads, well, they might struggle to get in the first team back home, never mind play for Great Britain. But in the end, we all know what happened, don't we? You know, the players who put the Great Britain shirt on, the 15 who played that day, well, just absolutely sensational. From 1 to 15, from whether it was Paul and David Hume getting ripped into the Aussie forwards, in what material like what they did, from Kevin Ward barnstorming, Andy Gregory just taking over the game, the Anderson Gill two tries and the boogie woogie, Paul Loughlin with the organisation, Phil Ford doing his stepping, and as I say, the late Mike Gregory, you know, scoring that wonderful try, not passing it to Martin Afire, which was great, wasn't it? You know, from a point of view where Greg says, "Hey, no, listen, I'm having my bit of glory here." So it was the start of the corner to be turned, because Mal really then knew that it was building a squad that together, and if it could keep us together injury free, then we had the quality of players that certainly not just could compete with Australia, but hopefully beat them. Yeah.
So you obviously represented Great Britain past 88, and captain the side as well. Did you notice a sense of the fact that you'd beaten them before going into the further test?
Without a doubt, yeah, because the big thing about it as well, because most of our major players have been out playing in the Sydney competition. So we looked at myself, you looked at Joe Lydon, you looked at Desi Drummond, you looked at Aaron Hanley, you looked at Martin Defy, you looked at Kevin Ward, you looked at Lee Crooks, you looked at Hugh Waddell played out there as well, who was making a name test for Steve Hampson as well. So we'd all played out in the Sydney comp, so we knew what the intensity were like. And but what we had to do to beat the Aussies was simple. You had to play for the full 80 minutes.
Yeah.
And because our competition over here was nowhere near as intense, you know, we've been saying since we've been out there since 84, 85 playing out there, that their competition is far more intense than what ours is.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the big reason.
Yeah.
Why they managed to hold on all the time and beat us 2-1. And but another thing I would say is, and that's no disrespect to all the other Great Britain players who was in our side, but they had 15 quality international players, and I would say we had maybe 8 quality players who could maybe play at that level for the 80 minutes. But unfortunately, a couple of players who maybe couldn't concentrate or maybe didn't have that quality to play for 80. How we got found out, but the big reason why we competed was because the majority of us went out to play in the Sydney comp and realised how intense it was.
Do you think, obviously, especially in the modern day, you've got the same with like some of the Burgesses, Gray and Whitehead, would you encourage more players to go over?
I don't, anybody who gets asked to go to the other world, just go.
Yeah. Do you think that would benefit England?
Of course it would, yeah.
Great Britain.
Yeah, of course it does. Because you played against quality week in and week out, and it's like if you look at the other nation in New Zealand. Why do you think New Zealand have won the World Cup? Why do you think New Zealand have been competitive? Because they're playing in the best competition in the world.
Yeah.
So it's all about intensity. It's all about playing against quality week in and week out. And I wish we had. I'd say 30, 40, 50 players in the NRL, because it would make us far better as an international side.
Yeah. So looking back on it all, now you're retired, do you think the sport as a whole could use victories such as the 88 and more as a motivation and a belief?
They won't take any notice of it.
They wouldn't.
Players of today won't take any notice of it. They won't take any notice of the victory what we did against Melbourne in 92. They won't take any notice of the victory we got against them at Wembley in 92. They won't take any notice of how close we took Australia in the World Cup final in 92. No, because they don't give us any respect. They won't take any notice of it.
Do you think they should?
Yeah, of course they should. Yeah, of course they should. But they won't.
Yeah.
They won't.
Why do you think that is? Just no respect?
Well, I guess the game has changed a little bit, but they just, unfortunately, they feel as though the game's been invented since 1996 to this present day. And I can reassure you, there's far more quality players back in our day than what there is today. And we were far closer to Australia than what we'll ever be. We've not been in Australia now for the last 12 years. You know, all right, the World Cup was 6-0, but let's not forget in 1992 we got beat 10-6. So to my mathematics, that only makes it 4 points, not 6. You know, so, but no, we don't get any respect from the current day players, unfortunately.
Are you still in contact with all the players that you saw?
We don't see each other often, because you know we've all got different lives now and all that. Like, from my point of view, my granddad now. So yeah, we've got a gathering tonight, Edinley. You know, 30 years of the Yorkshire Cup.
Yeah.
Well, there'll be a few lads there. So, but no, we don't get together as much as what we like to. But that's where the world works, I'm afraid.
So, have you noticed the introduction of the Ellis Rugby Heritage Range that they've brought out? The Ellis Rugby basically recreated like jerseys that you wore back in the 80s and 90s,
and
selling them and using them as a way of like reminding people and recognising the victories of the 88 and so on.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a good way of preserving history?
Yeah, of course it is, yeah, because it doesn't matter if it's sport or in life, without history you've got nothing.
Yeah.
That's what the world is. The world is all about history. You know, whether you're from England or Australia or America, Canada or wherever.
Yeah.
Without history, you've got absolutely nothing. And I'm all for the history of the game. I'm all for the Lions.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, they have a British Lions, once every year in January. You know, I'd like to see more British Lions dinners. Why don't we have it in Yorkshire? Why don't we have one in Lancashire? Why don't we take one in Cumbria? Why don't we take one up to Westall? Why don't we have a British Lions function every 3 or 4 months, take us on the road?
Yeah.
Because I know for a fact, certainly up in Cumbria, and I'm sure over at Hull as well, you know, where they're absolutely rugby league barmy.
Yeah.
You know, it would be a sellout. It would be a sellout to the people who want to celebrate the great game.
Yeah.
So the Lions should be going on the road, you know, and going to the heartlands of rugby league, and that's the four counties where I've just mentioned.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if you're aware or not, but there's plans to open a rugby league museum.
That's in Bradford, isn't it?
In Bradford, yeah. I was wondering what your thoughts are.
Oh yeah, well, yeah, the more heritage we have, what I'm sure let people know, what a great game we've got. You know, also too, before 1996, what a great game we had before that as well. You know, so and we was only just speaking the other day, myself, John Joyner, Colin Maskell, and Gary Errington, and it was a great 2-hour conversation about all the great players that have been with us, the likes of Neil Fox and Jim Mills and Mick Sullivan and Brian Bevan and Alex Murphy and all these guys, and just, you know, and Derek Turner's, Malcolm Reilly's, you know, how good they were, you know. And the funniest thing, what people ask me question is, do you think you'd be able to play in today's, game, Scotty? Well, for me, it'd be quite easy, because the 10 yards apart, in our days it was only 5 yards apart, so you had to create space, you had to create opportunities. So in today's game, you know, we would be quite simply even better, because we're getting more time and space.
Do you think the museum would be a good way of developing a sport, building a sport, by attracting visitors and saying you could be a part of such a sport?
I'm not so sure the museum would do that. I think what would do it, if you got more development officers around schools, and you got more development officers around, you know, the Cumbria, Yorkshire, Lancashire, different areas, and Stirling Hull, you know. So I'm not so sure a museum would do that. But what our museum's all about is just telling it the great history of what we've had.
Yeah.
You know, a museum's not all about to try and develop the game and get people playing the game. But a museum is a celebration of how great rugby league is, because it is a great game.
Yeah.
I was out there for the World Cup myself for 6 weeks, and it is a fantastic game. And when you see the people of Papua New Guinea turning out the thousands, I was in New Zealand for the Tonga v England game, that's just something that I'll never ever forget as long as I live. And so that's what International Rugby League does.
Yeah.
And it's a pinnacle of everybody's career. It's a pinnacle of what everybody wants to strive for. Whether you do it once or whether you do it 46 times like I have done, you never ever get bored of putting a national jersey on.
Yeah. Gary, that's all for me today.
Great stuff.
You'd be great.
Thanks, mate. Yeah,
thank
enjoyed
you
so
much
it.
For
yeah.
That.
No problem, mate. Yeah,
cheers.
Fine, yeah.
I'll let you get off.
Hopefully it helps you.
I won't take any more of your time.
No, yes, yeah, because I've got a couple of things to do, and then my cast later on. But, so.
What do you reckon tonight? You going?
Yeah, I'm going, yeah, because they're celebrating 30 years at Yorkshire Cup, aren't they?
So,
I fancy Leeds, but you never know with Cast here.
You never know.
Who do you follow them?
I'm a Rhino.
You're on Leeds here. Are you going?
I am, yeah.
Right.
I got my £10 shooting ticket.
Right.
So,
yeah,
I'll be right.
Okay, enjoy the game.
Yeah, thank you very
much. Enjoy it anytime, Okay,
cheers, mate. See you later.
Yeah.